Hey, Contra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplify, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. You know, when we think about these giant leaps in science, these revolutionary moments, we often picture this instant dramatic shift. Like, take Nicholas Copernicus. The story usually goes, quiet church guy publishes his big book, De Revolutionis, right as he's dying in 1543, and boom, Earth isn't the center anymore. Everything changes overnight.
Right. That's the myth, and it's a powerful one. But the sources we're digging into today, especially building on the incredible work of Owen Gingerich, they tell a really different story. Copernicus was absolutely crucial, no doubt about it. But the whole switch to a sun-centered universe, it wasn't Saturn at all. It was actually this, well, slow, pretty complex evolution of thinking that took about 150 years.
And that's really our mission for this deep dive, isn't it? To get past that simple lone genius's story and understand what really happened. How did this basically conservative scholar who was really motivated by like cosmic beauty of all things end up kicking off maybe the biggest paradigm shift ever? And crucially, why did it take so long for people to actually believe him?
Exactly. We're looking at the actual process here. What does it really take for a radical new idea to take hold? It involves, you know, patience, skepticism, and a whole lot of intellectual steps beyond just the first proposal.
Okay, let's unpack this. And to really grasp this long journey, we need a guide. And our guide is essentially Owen Gingerich, whose research gives us this amazing window into what happened right after 1543.
Yeah, Gingerich is just perfect for this because he wasn't just a historian. He was professor emeritus of astronomy and history of science at Harvard. So he was a practicing astronomer himself. He actually understood the really complex, dense mathematics that Copernicus was dealing with. That dual perspective astronomer and historian is, well, it's pretty rare and incredibly valuable here.
But the really wild part, the thing that gives his work such authority, is this amazing story about his research. He spent, what, 30 years tracking down nearly every single surviving copy of Copernicus's book from the 16th century.
That's right, 30 years. Imagine. He physically went and looked at these books all across Europe and even beyond. He wasn't just guessing who read it. He looked at the notes and the margins, the, you know, the underlinings, the little comments people scribbled. He gathered actual, physical, hard evidence of how real astronomers at the time were engaging with books.
So he could see how they were reading it, what parts they focused on, and I guess what parts they maybe disagreed with or ignored.
Precisely. He saw how they were using it, and crucially, how many of them were using the math while fundamentally rejecting the core idea of a moving Earth. Which leads to your next question, I bet.
Yeah, exactly. If these expert astronomers thought the moving Earth idea was, well, kind of nuts, why buy this incredibly expensive, super technical book and spend time writing all over it? What was the appeal?
That's the fascinating tension, isn't it? They engaged because even if they didn't buy the cosmology, the book offered something incredibly valuable as a tool. But okay, before we get into how the book was received, we really need to understand why Copernicus wrote it in the first place. What problem was he actually trying to solve?
Right. We need to set the stage. Before Copernicus, the universe ran on Ptolemy's system. Earth-centered, geocentric. And this model had been the standard for, gosh, 1,400 years.
And it was sophisticated. Ptolemy's Almagest was a masterpiece of ancient astronomy. It worked remarkably well for predicting where the planets would appear in the sky.
You use those clever geometric devices, right? The epicycles and deference.
Exactly. Little circles whose centers moved along bigger circles. It was a way to explain the complicated paths planets seem to take, including that weird backward or retrograde motion that planets like Mars sometimes do.
But over the centuries, to keep matching observations, astronomers had to keep adding more circles, making it incredibly complicated. But the sources say it wasn't just the complexity that bugged Copernicus, It was something specific.
Yes, this is key. It wasn't primarily about predictive accuracy, strangely enough. What really bothered Copernicus, the thing that drove his whole project, was a specific technical element called the equant.
The equant. Okay, what was that?
So the equant was this mathematical trick Ptolemy used. It was a point near the center of a planet's main orbit circle, the deferent. And Ptolemy said the planet moved at a uniform angular speed, not around the actual center of the circle, but around this off-center equant point.
Ah, so it's like fudging the math a bit to make the predictions work out.
Pretty much. It was a mathematical convenience, a fudge factor. And for Copernicus, who was deeply influenced by Neoplatonic ideas about the perfection and harmony of the cosmos, well, this equant was just ugly.
Ugly, like aesthetically offensive.
Exactly. It violated that core ancient Greek ideal of perfect, uniform circular motion where things move smoothly around the true center. Copernicus saw the equant as a kind of mathematical monster, a blemish on the beautiful, God-created cosmos.
Wow. So his main motivation wasn't necessarily, my predictions are way better, but more like, the current system is philosophically incoherent and messy, and I need to restore its elegance.
Precisely. He was acting in a way as a conservative, trying to restore the purity of ancient principles that he felt Ptolemy had violated. His goal was a more harmonious, more coherent, more beautiful system. And interestingly, his initial model wasn't actually much better at predicting planetary positions than Ptolemy's. Its real selling point for him was its philosophical and mathematical elegance.
That completely changes the narrative. The revolution starts with this deep, almost aesthetic dissatisfaction, asking a better, more fundamental question. What if the whole geometric setup is wrong? And that leads him to write the Revolutionibus, which finally gets published in 1543, thanks to his student Rheticus pushing him.
Right, and the book itself, De Revolutionibus Orbium Coelestium, on the revolutions of the heavenly spheres, it was deliberately modeled on Ptolemy's Almagest. It was huge, filled with complex geometry and calculations.
It's definitely not light reading then.
Oh no, it was aimed squarely at highly trained mathematical astronomers. Only a handful of people across Europe could even properly read and understand it.
Okay, so the book comes out, but then there's this twist with the preface, right? Something added that wasn't by Copernicus.
Yes, this is a crucial piece of the story. A Lutheran theologian named Andreas Usiander, who oversaw the final printing, anonymously added a preface to the reader. Usiander was likely worried about the theological storm the book might cause, you know, displacing Earth from the center. So his preface basically framed the whole heliocentric idea not as a description of physical reality, but merely as a useful mathematical hypothesis.
Like saying, hey, this is just a model, a way to calculate things. Don't worry about whether the Earth actually moves.
Exactly, a kind of intellectual insurance policy. And this preface had a huge impact on how the book was initially received.
And this is where Gingerich's census work becomes so revealing. He could see how people reacted to that preface.
Yes. His findings showed the book was bought and read by the experts. It was widely used in universities and by astronomers, but they used it primarily, as Osiander suggested, as a superior computational tool. They mined Copernicus's geometry and tables to create better predictions, like the famous Prutenic tables, which were much better than the old ones. But most of them explicitly rejected the core cosmological claim, the moving Earth, as physically absurd.
So this is fascinating. The theory existed in this weird limbo for decades. People used the math, but didn't believe the reality it described.
That's the critical point for understanding the first, say, 50 or 60 years after 1543. The math was accepted as a useful tool, but the cosmology was rejected. Copernicus provided the hypothesis, the framework, but he couldn't provide the definitive proof or the new physics needed to make a moving Earth plausible.
Which means the revolution wasn't a single event in 1543. It needed more steps, more people. It was cumulative. Copernicus started it, but others had to finish it. Who came next?
Well, the first key figure after Copernicus in terms of data was Tycho Brahe.
Ah, Tycho. The nobleman with the middle nose and the private observatory island.
That's the one. Tycho was, let's say, an interesting character, but he was also the greatest observational astronomer before the telescope. He actually developed his own hybrid model, Earth-centered, but with planets orbiting the sun, which then orbited the Earth.
So he didn't fully buy into Copernicus either.
Nope. But his commitment to accuracy was obsessive. He gathered decades worth of the most precise, detailed, naked eye observations of planetary positions ever made. This data was far better than anything Copernicus had, and that data became absolutely essential for the next big step.
And that next step was taken by Johannes Kepler, using Tycho's data.
Exactly. Kepler, who briefly worked for Tycho, inherited that treasure trove of observations. He was a brilliant mathematician and, unlike Tycho, a convinced Copernican. But he found that even Copernicus's model, with its perfect circles, didn't quite fit Tycho's ultra-precise data for Mars.
So what did he do?
After years of grueling calculations, Kepler had his breakthrough. Planets don't move in perfect circles. They move in ellipses, with the sun at one focus.
Ellipses, not circles. That must have been a huge conceptual leap.
It was massive. By switching to ellipses, Kepler could finally dish all the remaining complex circles, epicycles, that Copernicus himself still had to use. This made the heliocentric system dramatically simpler and vastly more accurate than Ptolemy's. Kepler's elliptical orbits were the mathematical key that unlocked the system's true power.
Okay, so Kepler nails the math and the geometry, making the sun-centered system work beautifully on paper, but you still need physical proof, right? Evidence that people can see.
Precisely. And that brings us to the third crucial figure, Galileo Galilei.
With his telescope.
With his telescope. Galileo didn't invent it, but he was the first to systematically turn it towards the heavens and understand the implications of what he saw. His observations, the phases of Venus, proving it orbited the sun, the moons orbiting Jupiter, proving Earth wasn't the only center of motion, the mountains on the moon, the spots on the sun, they didn't directly prove the Earth moved, but they systematically dismantled the old Aristotelian and Ptolemaic picture of the cosmos. Galileo became the system's most powerful advocate.
So it really took this chain. Copernicus asking the right aesthetic question, Tycho gathering the crucial data, Kepler finding the correct mathematical laws, and Galileo providing the telescopic evidence and advocacy.
That's the story. 150-year relay race, not a solo sprint.
It really does reshape how you think about scientific progress. So pulling back, what are the main themes, the big takeaways for us today from this whole saga?
Well, one I find really interesting is this idea of innovation as often being a conservative act. We think of revolutionaries as wanting to tear everything down. But Copernicus, he was driven by a desire to restore what he saw as the purity and harmony of ancient Greek ideals as perfect circles. Radical change came from wanting a better, more principled foundation.
That's a great point. Sometimes the biggest leaps come from trying to fix a fundamental flaw in the existing system rather than just throwing it out entirely. What else?
Second, definitely the patience required for scientific change, or really any major paradigm shift. 1543 wasn't the end, it was the beginning. It took generations, 150 years, for the evidence, the math, and the cultural mindset to align for full acceptance. Real change takes time, persistence, and usually requires multiple breakthroughs.
That's a humbling reminder in our, you know, instant gratification world. Patience is key.
And maybe a third related point is the power sometimes of the convenient hypothesis. Osiander's preface, though maybe intellectually dishonest, might have accidentally helped. By framing it as just math, it allowed the idea to circulate and be tested computationally without immediately triggering full-blown theological war. Sometimes an idea needs that intermediate step.
That's fascinating. Like, it needed camouflage to survive its early days. And thinking practically, there's the power of asking the better question. Copernicus didn't just ask for slightly better predictions from the old model. He asked fundamentally, is the geometry itself wrong? Is the Earth really the center?
Yes. And that's applicable anywhere, isn't it? If you're stuck on a problem, maybe you're asking the wrong question. Maybe you need to challenge a core assumption everyone else takes for granted instead of just looking for incremental improvements.
So looking back at the whole story, what's the one thing that really struck you or surprised you the most?
For me, I think it's the sheer interdependence of it all. Copernicus had the conceptual breakthrough, but it would have gone nowhere without Tycho's meticulous, lifelong slog of observation, Kepler's mathematical genius in interpreting that data, and Galileo's technological and rhetorical skill. It really underscores that even genius needs collaboration and context to ultimately succeed. Intellectual achievement is integrative.
Yeah, that's powerful. For me, honestly, it's still that initial motivation. The fact that this quiet, likely very devout church canon was willing to rearrange the entire cosmos fundamentally because he found the existing model.
Yeah.
Well, unaesthetic. It's just such a profound testament to the idea that beauty, symmetry, and mathematical elegance are deeply tied to our understanding of truth.
That's a beautiful way to put it. And there's a final irony, isn't there? The Copernican shift seemed at first to demote humanity, moving us away from the center. But ultimately, the entire process, this 150-year intellectual struggle, became this incredible celebration of human reason, our capacity to figure out the universe's structure through sheer thought, mathematics, and observation.
A paradox, indeed. Which, I suppose, leaves us with a final provocative thought to chew on.
Right. If the Copernican Revolution, the idea of a moving Earth, took 150 years to go from a convenient hypothesis to accepted physical reality, what major scientific or even social idea today is currently accepted only as a kind of useful fiction, a mere model? What inconvenient truth might our great-grandchildren look back on and say, wow, they really took their time accepting that?
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.